The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices. Conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Professor Jim Corbett, you're a professor of marine policy in the College of Earth, Ocean, and the Environment. Thank you so much for joining us on Campus Voices.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
We've asked you to come in because we're talking with a whole bunch of different people in April as the university celebrates both Arctic Month and Earth Month. And those two celebrations or time of increased attention are deeply entwined, and they both are right up your alley.
Yes, sir. The way that the oceans are used by international shipping for trade of goods among the continents and the nation's communities is very, very closely tied to understanding and the role of nature as an impediment or barrier to our transport. And our role as stewards of the ocean and coastal communities is becoming more and more forefront for how we move goods.
Over the last several weeks, I've seen different news stories about ice melting a lot earlier than usual in Greenland and up in the Arctic. What's going on there?
The general science and issues involve the warming trends around the globe and the way that ocean currents and warmer air masses move up into the Arctic. For the last 15 or 20 years, ice has been extending less and less permanently to the extents that we were used to. It still is seasonal. It grows and shrinks across the Arctic Ocean seasonally. But over the recent years, the ice has receded during the warmer months, the two warmer seasons of summer and fall, to the extent that navigation, shipping, and access to the resources in the Arctic have increased. And lastly, and perhaps not most importantly now, but very importantly in the future, the ice may recede to the point that there is a through Arctic route that would be open long enough to make it economically feasible for ships to take the shortcut, sort of a naturally emerging Panama Canal, Suez Canal, a naturally emerging new shortcut around the continents.
As we were getting ready for this conversation, you sent me some ArcGIS enhanced images based on satellite imagery, and I was just stunned to see the differences in the ice and snow between 1981 and 2012, which was the latest data they had there. And the shipping growth was just remarkable.
Yeah, the website that I pointed you to is a WWF website. It's managed by WWF out of Europe, and it's a real wonderful asset to visualize the layers of important ecosystems and human activity that the Arctic define. You can click on it's the. The URL that'll be linked, I'm sure, is arkgis.org, and it allows you to look at the sea ice extent over time, the sea thickness over time, but what I find really exciting is that I can overlay ecosystems and transportation records and oil resources, production wells for extracting energy out of the Arctic, and get a real sense of the competitive frontier that the Arctic is for resources and the important and iconic role that the Arctic plays with regard to the environment.
I think that the increasing ice melt in the Arctic, which is, as you've mentioned, is one of the areas that you're really doing a lot of research in, to some people it presents, economic opportunities. We can get our boats through here. And to others, it presents dangers.
Yes, in very general terms, climate change will produce winners and losers. And if we are in countries or related to consumption of resources that would benefit from increased access to the natural gas, oil, and living resources that are there, that can appear to us as an amazing opportunity, the Arctic frontier. If we also recognize that the feedback of the Arctic ice and the polar caps, that feedback mechanism on weather and climate and ocean current is critical to the stability of weather patterns and the severity of some of the effects of climate change, then an opening Arctic creates an important vulnerability that may mean we need to adapt or respond in ways that we may not have fully thought out. So it's a little bit of both.
I get the sense of what you're saying is that some people might be saying, oh, hot diggity, I can take the shortcut. Okay, that's great. They can do that. But meanwhile, further south and more moderate latitudes, we now have more radical shifts in the weather.
Sure, sure. And we can stay within the Arctic and make that same comparison.
Really?
It'll be a shipping shortcut for vessels that need to go from Asia to Europe. But if the native communities that live above the Arctic Circle use the frozen ice to resupply their villages and the ice goes away, they lose their shortcut. They now have to find alternative, more expensive ways, or they have to abandon their communities.
I think this is exactly the kind of thing that everybody's should be thinking about in terms of Earth Month. It's like, what's our relationship with the Earth, or in your case, what's our relationship with the ocean? And particularly if you're looking at it as a commercial entity, both for shipping, fishing, you know, gaining other natural resources, offshore oil drilling, and all that.
Exactly. Exactly. The economic benefits can be quantified fairly quickly. The feedback and potential impacts that may occur from a changing Arctic are less easy to quantify. And it's for a couple of reasons. First of all, the changes may in some ways be the die may be cast in some ways. So we may be just looking at the changes as they happen and have limited or more and more limited ability to reverse any changes we find to be undesirable. But secondly, there are folks working at companies who wear the green eye shades, and they're used to counting these resources, and so they are doing that full time. There are scientists and policy analysts like me and other sort of advocates for preserving the Arctic, and they may have some catch up to do on counting the benefits of helping to be better stewards of the Arctic. In all, the dialogue between those stakeholders is the most interesting to me, the most critical part of the process, because if we have a chance to take care of the Arctic and serve our needs as a people, we need to be able to exchange those ideas and priorities and not simply weigh one in favor of the other.
Shipping, its overall role in globalization, I think the things you're interested in, like the policies and the effects, not just on the Arctic, but globally, those topics seem right at the top of your research docket. And I know we've talked before this interview began about, you know, how this is not modern. I mean, you were mentioning the Phoenicians. I mentioned, you know, the Basque fishermen of the 15th century who, before Columbus discovered this, they'd found all these codfish over here in what's now North America and were using that as a way of getting to market in Europe when the Hanseatic League had blocked everybody
yes.
from bringing cod into ports.
Yep. There is a whole long history of how we have politically tried to control each other's nations in a race for resources during the age of exploration, and shipping and sailors are a big, big part of that.
I'm a big fan of Charles Mann's two books, 1491 and 1493, when he writes about the Americas before Columbus and then talks about globalization, you know, after exploration begun. And I didn't realize this, because I'm an English major, that in the 16th century, you got silver from Peru and Mexico. I thought it all went to Spain, but no, some of it went out over the Pacific to the east.
Sure.
It's not just a 20th century phenomenon, all this globalization.
No, but what has happened post-industrialization is that the technology of shipping has improved or grown or progressed, how you want to frame it. The technology of shipping in the days you're describing were limited by the ability to build a vessel that would sit in the water, not so deep that it had to plow through very, very resistant bodies of water. And it was propelled entirely by wind, except in coastal areas where you could use labor to pull the oars. So the size of the sail determined how deep the hull could be. In the age, that was the age of wooden ships and iron men, as the, you know, the literature will tell us. Later, we had what I like to call the age of power, where we had ships that were designed not to respond to nature, but more or less to move despite nature's changes. So yeah, we have weather routing. We avoid big storms. We don't like ships to get swamped and sink. But during the age of power, we were devoting our designs to bigger vessels, faster speeds. Some of these larger tanker ships that would carry oil around the world are longer from tail to bow, from bow to stern. They're longer than the Empire State Building is tall. And to be able to propel a vessel that goes more than 60 feet below the water's surface and goes at 15 to 20 knots, nautical miles per hour, so somewhere around the same speed that you'd have to drive through a school zone, the ships are going that fast, pushing that much material, requires a lot of power and a lot of energy. And when we switched from sail to steam and coal, and then to steam and oil, and then to engines and oil, we advanced the ability of ships to move more and more goods, more and more places safely and on time and faster. And that helped open up the opportunity for today's global trade and globally connected national economies.
I think when we talked last week, you mentioned the canals, Suez and Panama, and steam power, and that really accelerated the shipping. That made the ability, you didn't have to go around the capes.
Right. By taking the shortcuts between the major continents through those canals, vessels were able to save many, many days of voyage. And in addition to that, they were able to gain more customers, because as a vessel's moving along the populated parts of the mid-latitudes, there are many places where communities are dense enough to merit a port call for trade. So that's been a big boon.
One way of arguing this is all this shipping, and particularly once we have entered the age of steam, that it's really helped make the world a smaller place and give us the opportunity to understand each other and cultural exchange. But that's sort of a rose-colored picture of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of benefits to globalization along the lines of diverse cultures interacting, etc. But if we boil it down to the cargo for just a moment, and maybe as a cartoon to put in contrast to that more optimistic view of a smaller world, more integrated and knowing each other better, the shirt that we might be wearing that may be made out of cotton could be a three-continent shirt. It could be cotton grown in America, shipped to Africa to make into fabric, and then shipped to Asia to make into a garment, and then shipped back here for us to buy at a price that we find competitive and on sale right before school starts again.
Well, and some of your other colleagues have come in during Earth Month. We've talked about recycling and how in some parts of the world, like Egypt, juice boxes are recyclable. But in America, with the cost of labor, they go in the trash because it takes too much. There's too much labor cost in separating them. And it sounds like what you're saying is that even with the cost of shipping, that a lot of the economies are taking advantage of these labor differentials to sort of move things around.
As you bring it up, let me see if I can resurrect an example that I know in a coherent way. First of all, the waste paper that we generate here in the United States is a resource that can be recycled. Secondly, there are regulations that a lot of the packaging that goes into the products we buy need to be some percent post-consumer material. If you look up on the internet, I believe it is number one or two, but it's for sure in the top 10 of our exports by volume. We export waste paper to China so that they can use that material to help create the post-consumer packaging contents that we require.
By law.
by law. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing because, I say with a smile, but it is wonderful because the pulp and paper mills in North America are largely configured for most efficient operation off of virgin material, virgin lumber and wood products. And they are not well equipped to incorporate waste paper into their pulp and paper streams in North American mills. And it, if you do the dollar math, it is cheaper to send our waste paper back to China for packaging than it is to modify our pulp and paper industry away from virgin forest. I'm not exactly sure that that's the lovely synergy outcome that some of us would like to see, but in point of fact, we don't throw away all of the potentially recyclable materials because we don't want to process it here in the United States at U.S. labor prices. It's one of our major exports.
One of the things you told me about was a movie that just, and this ties in because they talk about waste paper in it and moving it around. This movie just opened in Germany on March 30th, and I think it just debuted in the United States on April 16th at a festival in San Francisco. It's a movie called Freightened, about this the enormous container shipping industry and this global trading machine that's had a lot of positive benefits, but a lot of side effects as well.
The movie Freightened, as a pun on the word frightened, but spelled with the first part like freight, is an international documentary that explores the invisibility of the freight sector. When we go to stores or when we understand where that raw materials go into our products, we often forget how many continents, how many cultures, and what the staging is for moving those raw materials to places where we can make semi-finished intermediate products that then end up to fabrication or manufacturing where we make our final products, and then we send them to the markets. One of the missions, I think, of that film, which I have yet to see other than the trailer, is to make more transparent the multiculturalism that's embedded in the shoes and the belts and the foods that we consume in our economies here in North America, in Japan, and in Europe, where you know major of the fully developed economies in terms of consumption are.
I haven't seen the movie yet either, obviously, but I'm a little worried they might have pulled out all the emotional stops. They've chosen the startling image for poster use. It's of a young woman wading into the ocean at a beach, and meanwhile, anchored just offshore is a rusted, overloaded cargo ship.
I think that they have a number of different images they're trying to use, but I have to admit that my previous life before academia here at the university was as a merchant mariner and a marine engineer sailing on those rusty vessels and operating that technology, and my eye was quickly drawn away from the bikini to look at that ship to wonder what was inside. What I think is true, and I think the point that you're raising, is that there is possibly room for some very pointed perspectives on the aspects of the freight network and the supply chain that we may not have thought of. And Freightened does seem to aim with both feet to stand on that position. And I think I would only observe that there's plenty of other places where our image and understanding of consumption could potentially benefit from a little of that perspective.
One of the points that's made in the trailers, one you've already made, is that many times locally made goods are more expensive for consumers than things made overseas and then shipped here. And you went even deeper than that, talking about the whole fabrication process.
Right. I think so I'm not a trade economist, and I don't want to get into, I don't have much vocabulary for discussing the political ins and outs of offshoring certain processes versus others. But in a global context, transportation, inexpensive transportation, has been used since before the 1850s, before the age of industrialization. Inexpensive transportation has been used to seek out less expensive labor, employ it in the process of adding value to special products, and then getting those products back to the consumers who could most afford and most desire those. It is certainly not an American phenomenon. It's not a new phenomenon. It may be happening at a scale because of global shipping.
Because of the new technology.
Yeah. That is 21st century scale, and it may be time for a call to better stewardship for how vessels operate around the world, how ports function in the sustainable movement of goods and people. And that's the area that I'm interested in focusing on, is understanding the long-term slow change to convert vessel technologies or energy technologies in transportation from sail to steam, from steam to engines. Those took five or more decades, and they were entirely motivated by a globalizing world. In this century, if we need to make some transitions to more efficient, lower greenhouse gas technologies, more efficient ships, or ships that are more careful about how potentially invasive species are carried on their hulls or in their tanks, those changes may also take many, many years. And it's important that we understand in what I call potentially, I like to label the 21st century for transportation as potentially the age of stewardship. So we had the age of sail, the age of power, and this may be the age of some stewardship, where we really bring to bear behaviors and technologies into shipping that will serve the mission of preserving the oceans and making the goods we buy less impactful.
We talk about globalization and as if, you know, we're all equal partners here, but a lot of the countries don't see it that way. They say, well, come on, it's our turn to make the money. How dare you tell us to not do what you've done for the past 50 years in the shipping industry? And
so let me make sure I understand what you mean by what the shipping industry has been doing.
Well, I'm getting at the sense of talking about the age of stewardship. In order to get everybody on board with the age of stewardship, you're going to have to get people with all sorts of different economic interests, first world, third world, whatever you want to call them,
absolutely,
to agree that this should be a goal.
So here's the way I see it. You make a very, very good point. The first acknowledgement that I'll make is that the world's shipping industry and us as consumers, we may have to go kicking and screaming into the age of stewardship. It's not something that we're rushing forward to with open arms. So it is not an easy transition. I would note just briefly that the transitions to coal and to diesel engines were perceived with a lot of resistance by many in the industry at the time as well, and the motivations there were at least as strong or stronger than these. So you make a good point. The part where I might take issue with you is that we do not need 190 nations to agree in lockstep on how to proceed in order to create very important positive change in the international transportation sectors for aviation and shipping at least. There are lead adopters already finding ways to invest in the most energy efficient, cutting edge technologies, and the economic conditions after the recession have reminded the world transportation system that there's a lot of options, including something called slow steaming, driving at slower speeds across the ocean's surface, can allow goods to be reliably delivered to market on time for consumption at much reduced greenhouse gas input, some energy savings, and potentially other benefits in terms of environmental discharges to the water or to the air.
Last week you told me that if you put the aviation and shipping industry together, they would rank, what, number six?
Just shipping alone.
Just shipping.
Would rank sixth. If, you know, so this
in terms
is,
of kicking carbon out into the atmosphere.
Right. So specifically, shipping produces, uses energy at a rate that results in about 3% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuels. 3% is a small number. It's less than the United States. It's less than China. It's less than India. But it's more than Japan, and it's about twice Germany. So if you were to take the international shipping emissions, which are not currently allocated among the 190 nations, they are left out of the rankings by nation. If you go to Wikipedia or to some smarter place to look at the rankings of CO2 emissions by nations, you will not find international shipping in that list, and you will not find international aviation. The Kyoto Protocol left them explicitly out and it's because of their role in global trade. If you were to include them without thinking about how they should be included back in 1990, you might have disadvantaged some of the most vulnerable nations from their opportunities to use trade to grow their standards of living. Or you might have unfairly aligned trade with the owners of the ships or the owners of the cargo or the sellers of the fuel. There were too many different stakeholders, and none of them had common nationalities among any of those ways of working it out. And so ships and aviation, ships and planes, were allowed to remain outside of the initial Kyoto Protocol. And what I found interesting as an academic and surprising maybe as a citizen in favor of some sort of global agreements that occurred last November in Paris is that the Council of the Conference of Parties that agreed to the first greenhouse gas reduction strategies last year removed from the draft language commitments for aviation and removed from the draft language commitments for shipping and left them to their international regulatory agencies. This week, during Earth Month, the Marine Environment Protection Committee at the International Maritime Organization is meeting, and one of the top items on their agenda is how they will bring a commitment to the shipping industry so that it also participates in the necessary reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, recognizing, in fact, that it is not a minor contributor to climate change, but it is in the top 10 among nations.
We're just about out of time here talking with Jim Corbett from the College of Earth, the Ocean, and the Environment. Are there any action items for our listeners?
Well, I think it's important that people try to understand the supply chain for the goods they buy. We have a large group of students, faculty, and the public who recognize when they're using animal products. And they have various perspectives on how to ethically and sustainably use those products or to avoid using those products. I think similarly, it's worthwhile for us to look not only at the price tag of the goods that we have, but to recognize that the supply chain, the effort, and that the human element in the things we sit on, the things we wear, and the things we plug in is very, very important. Perhaps the least visible of that is the vessels and very small numbers of people operating those vessels who transport those goods back and forth. So again, we also have a lot of folks that spend good time looking at labor practices of corporations in their supply chain overseas, child labor, etc. Those kinds of issues are not simply at the ends of the supply chain, but they're connected by a set of wonderful fleet of ships and very dedicated people who we won't usually ever see or think of. I think the other thing that I might do is for those folks who listen to this who like to go on cruises, that you recognize that when you're on a cruise ship, you're on the very most visible tip of the iceberg of an industry that carries cargo other than people and is never photographed. And I think that would be a terrific thing for folks to learn more about.
Jim Corbett, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.